We've been looking throughout the season of Advent and Christmas at some of the famous Christmas carols and looking at the history of those Christmas carols and then looking at some of the meaning we might draw from them. Today is one that's not sung very often, but it's certainly something we're all familiar with. We Three Kings. We Three Kings was originally entitled The Three Kings of Orient, also known as We Three Kings of Orient Are, or also it has the title sometimes of The Quest of the Magi. It is a Christmas carol that was written by John Henry Hopkins Jr. in 1857. At the time of composing the carol, Hopkins served as the rector of Christ's Episcopal Church in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, and he wrote this Christmas carol for a Christmas pageant in New York City. It is the first widely popular Christmas carol to be ever written in America. Interesting, eh? I don't know if you noticed as we sang through it, he organized the carol in such a way that three male voices would sing each verse as a solo to correspond with each king. The first and last verses of the carol were to be sung together by all three as verses of praise, while the intermediate verses are sung individually as the kings each describe their verse or their gift and what it meant. The Magi solos are typically not observed now in contemporary performances of this carol. The carol's melody has been described as sad and shifting in nature. By the way, wasn't that nice, Carol doing it with music? I love that. Because of this, this song deeply resembles a song from the Middle Ages or maybe Middle Eastern music, both of which it is frequently compared to. As you know, the carol is centered around the biblical Magi who visit Jesus as a child. I hope you caught this in the gospel lesson, in a house, not the stable. It happened sometime after his nativity, and they came and they gave him gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh while paying homage to him. They worshiped him. And though the event is recounted in the Gospel of Matthew, we don't have any further comments about the Magi anywhere in the New Testament. We don't have anything in the Bible that tells us their names or even the number of Magi that came. It also doesn't say they were royal. We're going to get to that. Surprisingly, though, there are verses in the Old Testament that foretell these visitors. Isaiah 60 verse 6 reads, "The wealth of the nations will come to you. A multitude of camels will cover you. The young camels of Midian and Ephah, all those from Sheba will come. They will bring gold and frankincense and will bear good news of the praises of the Lord." Does that sound familiar? Now, the number three that we associate with all the nativity scenes comes from the fact that there were three separate gifts. And people thought, well, each Magi brought a gift. The Greek of the New Testament, when translated, simply calls these visitors the Magi from the East. And the term Magi is usually translated by us as magicians. It's the same root word. But these were wise men. They were astrologers. And the East has variously been identified as any country from Arabia or Babylonia or Media or Persia, all of which is part of modern-day Iran. They were probably Iranians, can you imagine? But they didn't come from further east than that. The Magi were an ancient priestly caste among the Babylonians and the Medo-Persians. And these priest sages, as they were called, were extremely well-educated men for their day. They were experts in religion and history and medicine and astronomy and astrology and divination and magic. As I said, the safest conclusion is that the Magi of the Nativity were either Persian or Babylonian, Maybe they were both, because at one time Persia was controlled by Babylon. Whatever their origin, their visit was of great significance for later Christianity. The wise men were pagans. We need to remember that. They were not Hebrew people. And the fact that the Gentile magi performed the same adoration as the Jewish shepherds symbolized the universal outreach for the future Christianity. The Old Testament lesson, the prophet Isaiah foretold this momentous event. Nations, that is Gentiles, shall come to your light and kings to the brightness of your dawn. Does that sound familiar? And so they have, since Gentiles comprise the overwhelming majority of Christians today, the Magi are our representatives at the Nativity. The light they saw in the baby at Bethlehem pierced the darkness of their paganism, just as the light of the world can illuminate the darkness of sin and ignorance, fanaticism and terrorism surrounding us today. The great good news of how God revealed his Son was that it wasn't just to Jewish people. It was to humanity everywhere. The gifts of the wise men that they brought to the baby Jesus were also very significant in what they represented. Gold was to honor of a king. The king is Jesus, of course, who's the king of all kings. Incense was a gift to someone who was priest. It was said that Jesus would be our great high priest who made intercessions for us. And myrrh, well, that's a burial spice. And it was to represent when Jesus was crucified, died, and was buried. But it didn't end there, did it? All of this is so significant in the wonderful feast of what we call the Epiphany, which is what we're in right now. It means manifestation. By the way, January 6th is the day of Epiphany, which is 12 days from Christmas Day to Epiphany. But the arrival of the Magi to see Jesus prompts, at least in my mind, one of the most interesting questions to ask someone if they are a Christian or claim to be a Christian. And that is to ask them directly, what first drew you to Jesus? Mark Buchanan, a noted Baptist author and pastor, suggests that even though there are a variety of experiences, most people fall into two categories in their coming to Jesus. There are those who, like the Apostle Paul, are surprised. They are knocked literally off their feet. They are the people who are just minding their own business, and one day Jesus just shows up and says, hello. The shepherds of the Christmas story, that's their experience, isn't it? Here they are just minding their own business, looking after the sheep in the hills of Bethlehem. I picture them just kind of sitting around a fire, sharing stories, trying to get themselves and their sheep through a difficult night without a predator sneaking in to grab a lamb, and hoping and praying that a big storm didn't come up to cause all kinds of havoc. And the sky suddenly explodes with brightness and voices announcing Jesus' birth. And these men, these shepherds, respond to what they see and hear as, let's go see this thing that has happened. This is the experience of some people. People are just minding their own business and wow. There's also another group of people who encounter Jesus in more like a long journey. They are represented by the Magi, who took a very long time to get to Jesus. Unlike the shepherds, these men were not afraid of the night. In fact, they always look forward to the night. It was during the night that they could study the stars, they could scour the heavens for signs. And these men had studied many years the ancient writings from all kinds of cultures looking for prophecies about the major events that were to take place. Their motivation was really quite simple and quite human. They were looking for the meaning of life. They have, we might say, been spiritually hungry for a very long time. This is the other kind of person we meet in the spiritual experience of God's people. They too are just minding their own business, but their business is finding the truth that is worth living for and dying for, and they're ravenously searching for it. Now, you and I, we often wonder how many magi or wise men there were. We don't know. We really don't. Church tradition says three, but that could be because, as I said, there's the three gifts. There could have been 12 gifts of gold, 4 gifts of myrrh, etc., for all we know. We know they traveled hundreds of miles, and despite what we might think and what is often depicted on Christmas cards, they would have traveled with a great caravan. They would have come with servants and maybe even their own security, possibly. They would have had amongst them many camels for their supplies for the long journey. And when we think about it this way, that's very important, because when they entered the city of Jerusalem, it caused quite a ruckus. All these strange people, all these pack animals, all this noise would have caught everyone's attention. They would have been like a parade going through the town. Nobody could miss them, including those who were loyal to King Herod. There's something very important about these magi that we need to continue to remember. We tend to want to Christianize these men. We want to make them kind of like pseudo followers of Judaism or early followers of Jesus, but they were, by every description, pagans. Their cultural background was pagan. The very word magi is the word we get magic from. These guys were magicians. And I'm not talking about the kind like David Copperfield, by the way. They didn't work at perfecting parlor tricks or sleight of hand. No, they truly believed in the power of magic like Harry Potter. They firmly believed that if they had all the right knowledge and all the right activities, they could manipulate events and nature itself. They were also astrologers, as I mentioned. They believed that they could predict events by looking at the movement of the stars. And at some point in their searching for the truth, they saw something in the sky and they knew something special had happened. Something so momentous that it was worth the longest, most arduous journey of their lives, and something that was worth bringing their very best gifts. They agreed together that there was something out there. They decided that they had to go and they had to search. And one of the lessons from the story is that God is very passionate about revealing his glory to the nations, so that in turn the nations will bring glory to him. So the question rises about how many ways are there to God according to the Bible? Just one, right? How do you get to God? Through Jesus, right? He is the way. Yet here we can ask another question. How many ways are there to Jesus, first of all? It's a different yet very crucial question, wouldn't you agree? The answer is, well, how many people are there? Jesus is using all kinds of wonderful ways to draw people to himself. I don't know if you've been following, but recently there have been lots of stories coming out of the Middle East about people having dreams about Jesus, especially in Muslim countries where the Bible and missionaries are banned. We read about people receiving badly needed items after praying for them and receiving answers to needs for healing, etc. You know, God is, through Christ, is incredibly imaginative when it comes to reaching people and bringing them to himself. What might surprise you, though, is that such methods, while incredible, are not God's first choice to reach people. God would prefer that his people, you and I, should be light. Actually, that we might be the Star of Bethlehem. You ever been called that? Paul says in Philippians 2, 14 to 15, do everything without complaining or arguing so that you may become blameless and pure, children of God without fault in a crooked and depraved generation in which you shine like the stars in the universe. You and I, we know people today, just like in the ancient world, who were into all kinds of things. There are people who take very seriously what their horoscope says, just as the Magi did 2,000 years ago. You know, the church is very quick to tell them that they're wrong, that they're stupid, or they're sinful in doing such a thing. But how do we respond to the hunger that that behavior represents? We are to be light. Light shining in these dark places. But if we fail, God will find other ways to reach people. The story continues that the Magi reached Jerusalem. What a scene that must have been. Those who saw them immediately knew what they represented. These were very learned men, but Matthew also wants us to see in them something childlike. They are a bit naive. They come to Jerusalem because that's the capital city of Judah. They're quite open about what they're looking for. Where's the newborn king? Where do we find him? The Magi were giddy with excitement. They thought their journey was soon going to be over. Surely the new king would be in Jerusalem, the holy city of the Jews. When word gets to Herod, the reigning king, Herod becomes disturbed. I don't know if you noticed it in the scriptures, as does all of Jerusalem. Here is the naivety on the Magi's part. They think religious people would be interested. They think that the people who have held the prophecy for hundreds of years, who cherished the hope for centuries, were going to be as excited as they were. How short-sighted the Magi were. To think that just because people have knowledge, they would want to act on that knowledge. They forgot what happens in the hearts of people when they know the truth. Sometimes they become arrogant and complacent, and they simply just stop looking. Have you seen him, the king? The king is born. Do you know where he is? Stop bothering me, you crazy Magi. I'm busy shopping for Christmas. You know, people get so caught up in the commercialization of Christmas, we forget that the king was born. A king who is Christ the Lord. The culture we live in, it shrouds the shining star like clouds that cover the night sky. And here's where the Magi story begins to intersect with our own. It rebukes us. The people who are the least in possession of the truth are the most hungry for the story. The Magi are simply working on a hunch. They read the stars. They got a sense that God was up to something important. They searched the Hebrew text and they made a connection. In the story, we see that evil, however, can be perpetrated by those who possess the truth. Disturbed and twisted by his own lust for power, Herod inquires of his own religious leaders as to the truth of what these Magi are talking about. His own religious scholars, the Jewish religious scholars, knew very well where the new king was to be born. They knew chapter and verse. Oh yes, it's Bethlehem. The prophet said so long ago. We've studied this for years. We've preached on it. We've had Bible studies on it. We've written articles on it. The Magi came on a hunch. But the Jewish leaders had the full truth and they didn't want to have anything to do with it. Absolutely nothing. The Magi had made a several hundred mile journey. It was arduous. It was dangerous. It was scorching through the desert. They came on a hunch. The religious leaders of Jerusalem had only had to travel 5 miles. And they couldn't be bothered. And that's an important lesson for all of us, isn't it? We need to understand that God doesn't reward the knowledge in your head as much as he rewards the hunger in your heart. Here's an interesting observation. Some of these religious leaders who advised Herod would still be alive later on when Jesus is carrying out his ministry. It is true that the story of the Magi's visit would have been passed down from generation to generation, from sons and nephews who had actually physically seen the Magi from the east. Do you know what Jesus said to them some years later? To these people who thought they knew it all? He says in John 5, "You diligently study the scriptures because you think that by them you possess eternal life. There are the scriptures that testify about me, yet you refuse to come to me to have life." You know, Bible knowledge is fantastic, but if it's not bringing you closer to Jesus, it's a dangerous thing. I should mention, and it's important, that there's one person in this story who possessed the truth and does something about it. But it's not what God wanted anybody to do. It's King Herod, sometimes called Herod the Great. Herod the Great was known for his lavish living. He was also known for his own pagan ways. He set up idols to all kinds of gods in his palaces. He was also notorious for his murderous ways. He was a deeply paranoid man about people who were seeking to overthrow him. By the time the Magi arrive in Jerusalem, Herod had already killed his wife, 3 of his biological sons, his mother-in-law, his brother-in-law, his uncle, and many others who might have a claim to the throne. If you appeared in any way to be a threat to his hold on power, he simply had you killed. Herod had also been searching for the Christ child, but he did so for a different reason, didn't he? He tells the Magi that he too would like to find the child and bring him a gift and worship him. What a filthy lie. The only gift he wants to bring comes at the end of a sword. Now we might think we are nothing like Herod, but we can learn something from him. We may not be out to kill the Christ child, but we would need to realize that we cannot sit on the throne and have Jesus there too. There's no room for both of us. It's one or the other, but not both. In our hearts, we often set Jesus up as a rival to our own kingdom. We say, well, Jesus, you can rule as long as it's okay with me. And don't encroach on areas that I've decided that are my domain. So how often have we said to Jesus, I'm Lord of this, thank you very much. The funny thing about Herod is, he understood what was going on. He got it. For all his depravity, for all his malice, for all his narrowness, bitterness, and paranoia, he got it. He understood you can't both be king and have him king. He knew that. You can't both be on the throne and have him on the throne. It's one or the other. So Herod decided to destroy his rival. For all the evil portrayed in Herod, he ends up giving the best advice in the whole story. Go and make careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report back to me that I might go and worship him as well. Now, he's lying, of course. He's going to go with a dagger under his cloak. But we need to heed his words. We need to go and make a careful search for the child. If you are steeped in the truth, but it's been a while since you did something with that truth, then please go and make a careful search. If you are steeped in some confusing ideas about the divine, or you know someone who is, don't get all twisted up trying to fix their theology or correct it. Instead, get them to Jesus. Go and make a careful search with them to find the Christ child. Because in our seeking, our theology becomes clear. If it's 5 miles away, go. If it's 100 miles away, go. Go make a careful search for the child. And when you find him, worship him and tell others about what you have found, so they too might come and worship him. He's the one worthy of our long journey. He's the one who satisfies that hunch you might have about the meaning of life. He is the one worthy of the gifts that we might bring him. Gold, incense, or whatever else is precious to us.